Okay.
Okay, good. Yes. I'm Liz Frobel. I work with Rena at Akiva. I teach in the upper school. So she asked me to replace her for tonight. It's a pleasure because I've been teaching high school and I know that you guys are much more thoughtful and, you know, high school is a tough time of life. We've matured past that. So I have high expectations of you.
And you show up.
Right, and you show up and you, yes, exactly, you show up.
That's true.
The school, what do they say, the college of life is tougher than any other school you'll be in.
Problems in this class.
Okay, good, right. That's what I think. So that's good. So until, get better, okay, so here, I'll tell you what.
What are you looking for?
Let's see. So here, this book, one copy. Okay, can you guys write? That table will have, they have a copy.
On the first one. You know.
And you'll have a copy?
She should have told us we were going
to.
Yesterday we're going in order.
Okay.
They all have the same one.
Yeah.
They all have the same book.
And here, let me give you at least the first sources in here.
So.
Okay. Well, good. It'll have to be participatory because I don't really have a copy. Okay, good. So this, it's Parsha Mishpatim, as we know. Next week you'll know it's in a new this Parsha and on is in a new volume. Just to an overview of what the Parsha is called Parsha Mishpatim. Hazard a guess. What is it about? What's in Parsha Mishpatim?
Judging.
Okay, good. Rules. Excellent. Just tons of rules. So the first article in this is Parsha is, you know, she picks one of the first rules. I actually photocopied, I think in the text they quote one pasuk. I didn't understand a lot of her questions until I read the next two pasukim as well. So the first source you see is a copy of that pasuk and then the next two. So anybody want to read us what the text that she's dealing with? Right there. We start in Hebrew, go to English.
Just read from here?
Yes. Well, so how about if you want, you can read from the source sheet because I photocopied you two extra pasukim. As I said, we'll see in a minute. If you just read the first pasuk, I think you don't fully understand some of her questions.
So from here?
Yeah, so exactly. So from
there. Higno ish or so it's pachal o mecharo chamisha b'kayi shalim pachat hasher b'abat son pachat hasa. Keep going?
Well, okay, why don't you translate or help us out here. Let's translate that pasuk.
All right. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, I don't know what it's called for me, and slaughters or sells it, five oxen shall he pay for the ox,
okay,
and four sheep for the sheep.
Okay, good. All right. So this sets out, so somebody steals an ox or a sheep, and this is important, the thief has to actually slaughter it or sell it. In other words, he gets rid of it, he fences it quickly. In that case, he has to, if he's caught, he has to pay five cattle back and four sheep back. You can kind of anticipate what kind of question, you know, we're going to be asking about this. But continue, we're still on the topic of theft here, even though it goes into the next paragraph, we are still on the
Hebrew one.
Okay.
Im b'machtera imatzei ha'agana v'hukav amin v'ein lo damim. Im zarcha ha'shem ha'shalav damim lo shalim ha'shalim im ein lo v'nim char big nivato. Im himatzei b'yadel ha'gneva mishar ad chamar ad tzechayim shnayim ha'shalim.
Okay, so this is a famous case, and I think actually the next article talks all about Pesukim Aleph and Bet, about a thief who comes in and is killed by the owner of the house, what happens. But I was more interested in the last Pasuk Gimel, because it has another case, Im Hatzeh Matzeh V'yado HaGneva. So if the thief still has the stolen property in his possession, Mishor Ad Chamor Ad Tzeh Chaim. So again, we're still talking about the ox. We add in a donkey here, but an ox or the sheep, and it's alive. Still has it. Hasn't gotten rid of it. Shnayim Yisalem. How many does he have to, if he's caught, how many does he have to pay back?
Two.
Okay, so we have, you're going to see, you know, we have kind of different payback systems. What does the payback system depend on? What are kind of the two variables here?
What you steal.
Okay, good. So one thing is what you steal. Okay, excellent. We have a distinction made between an ox and between a sheep. And what about pasuk gimel versus the first pasuk?
What you do with it.
Good, what you do with it, right? If for some reason if you've gotten rid of it by killing it or selling it, you have to pay back much more than if it's actually found in your possession. So again, I don't know why, if you, most of us don't have the book, but for some reason in the book they only quote the first pasuk, but then she goes on to ask about the third pasuk as well. So, but now we have all the pasukim out there, so we can understand what's going on. Okay, so those are the pasukim. Okay, so actually, all right, so what kind of questions do you think, I don't know, Nechama is going to ask here? We have this.
Why the different? Why the different numbers?
Okay, excellent. Okay, excellent. Good. So that's, I don't know what to do since we only have two. We only have two texts. But yeah, good. Okay, that's one of our questions. Okay, right. Why the different numbers? Well, and again, the different numbers in two senses. Why is the distinction made between a sheep and an ox? And why is the distinction made between if you have it in your possession or you've already gotten rid of it? So let me see.
Sheep are easier to steal than an ox.
Sheep. Okay, good, good, good. Okay, so let's get to. Okay, so let's see what she has to say. Do you want to read where she goes with this?
In English?
Yeah. I mean,
theft is an offense in all societies.
You will? I don't know.
Not even sheep.
Sheep is a shepherd.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Excellent. Okay, good. It happens to be, so again, we're going to see, I mean, a basic outline of what's going on here. She does a little comparison between the laws, you know, in Tanakh and Chumash and the Code of Hammurabi. In other words, what were other cultures doing about sheep, about oxen, about these movable goods? Then she's going to address the...
What about the
chamor? Okay, good. Then she's going to ask why we have the difference between if you have it in your possession and you don't, and then why the difference between the sheep and the ox. Why is the chamor added in the second case but not mentioned in the first case? Okay, so that's kind of where she's going to go with this. And your whole, it was interesting, your discussion about the sheep. There's actually, she's going to bring two contradictory sources. Some are going to say it's easier to steal sheep. Some are going to say it's harder. And therefore, that's what she does a lot, right? She, you know, these mafarshim who are completely opposite each other. So you've anticipated where we're going with this. Okay, so first let's see how our laws about, cattle rustling and...
Right. Rambam includes it under the category of laws or dinim in the seven Noahide precepts. In my view, the category of dinim, which our rabbis included amongst the seven Noahide precepts, did not just refer to the appointing of judges in every district. It also commanded them to observe the laws against theft, fraud, oppression, withholding of wages, damages, etc. Genesis 34:13. The codices of antiquity, including the Babylonian and Hittite, discovered within the last century, include detailed laws prohibiting theft, kidnapping, cattle rustling, etc. But the penalties imposed are vastly different from those found in the Torah. The Hammurabi Code imposes penalties on theft that vary with the status of the victim, depending on whether the ox was stolen from the king, temple, a man of middle station, a slave, etc. The sliding scale of penalties range from death at one end to tenfold at the other, with 30-fold in the middle for good measure. If the thief could not pay the penalty, it was death. Several scholars have pointed out that one of the crucial differences between the Torah and the Babylonian Codex is the fact that the former makes no distinction between rich or poor, king or priest. It goes without saying that the death penalty is only invoked for the kidnapper. The Torah does differentiate between the penalty imposed on the cattle thief who is still in possession of his loot and the other one who has slaughtered or sold it. Rambam formulates the biblical rule in his code.
Okay, great. So luckily these sources also I have out here after this, we're kind of going to have to just swing it. if you put these two pages together, it forms one and two. Let's see, yeah, my computer just printed them out two at a time. So the big source in the middle, Ramban Breshit, that's what you quoted first. The Ramban here, Nachmanides, lived a little bit after Rambam, so he's able to quote Rambam in here. Nachama uses it to establish the fact that, you know, stealing was a universally, you know, accepted crime. I don't think we have time right now, but if you're interested, I mean, in this Ramban, the Ramban is actually dealing with Vayanu b'nei Yaakov et Shchem v'et Hamor aviv b'mirma in Breishit, when Shchem and Hamor take Dina, forcibly take Dina. In the end, Shimon and Levi attack them and kill everybody there, all the men there. So it's very interesting. Ramban is dealing with this ethical question of why is that warranted? It seems a little bit harsh for the crime, killing every man, that kind of thing. So he quotes Rambam and his ideas to try to justify it by the fact that the people of Shem were not following the laws of Noach, and the laws of Noach, infractions on those are punishable by death. So it's a very interesting Ramban, you know, to talk about, and what are the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, which is a huge, huge topic. How much do they cover? But anyway, so she just really quotes that, though, to establish the fact that stealing is a universal problem. Now, she then compares how the Torah, you know, the penalties of the Torah to the Code of Hammurabi. Your last source there in English here is the quote, is an excerpt, just a small excerpt of the Code of Hammurabi. Yeah, there are excerpts of that. If you're interested, I got this off the internet. It looks like there are hundreds of different translations of it. I can't guarantee this is the most scholarly translation, but it was the easiest to access as opposed to going to the university library and getting it. So if you don't, you know, believe the excerpt in your book, or if you want to compare, Google Code of Hammurabi, and there you go. You can spell Hammurabi, 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 doesn't matter. It's Mesopotamian, so it'll work.
What's the Code of Hammurabi?
Oh, okay, but the Code of Hammurabi, no.
Those are different than the seven Noahide.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Okay. Yeah, the seven Noahide laws are, you know, are ours. And they're, you know, the way we derive them from, there's actually a good book by, I think it's from Aaron Lichtenstein, about the differing ways that we derive the seven mitzvot of B'nai Noach, what they are. There's a big machlokah between Rambam and Ramban about how far, and actually Ramban touches in it in this Ramban, about how much they encompass and what the penalties are and everything like that. But, you know, so that's our thing. The Code of Hammurabi is actually, I believe it was found, again, you can Google this, in the late 1800s, modern-day Iraq, someplace in the Fertile Crescent. It's an amazing, it's a very, very complete code of law. What you see is eight, there are over 100, between 100 and 200 laws. And I really encourage, if you want, it's really interesting because it sounds, it's formulated a lot like Mishpatim. You can see, just look on the board, if anyone, key, and all the Mishpatims are also key. I mean, it's a general ancient Near Eastern way of doing it. We have snippets of other ancient Near Eastern law codes, but this, by far, we have the most extensive. It's the most extensive thing. And if you look at the top, he has a whole introduction. Hammurabi was the king of Mesopotamia. When Marduk was one of the gods, the main god, sent me to rule over men to give the protection of the right of land. I did right and righteousness and brought the well-being of the oppressed. So he does believe that he's bringing down divine laws. Yeah.
It's interesting, if you scrabble the letters around, you get almost Abraham out of Hammurabi.
There are some opinions that Abraham lived in the time of Hammurabi. That's like, there are different opinions on how to date, you know, when Abraham lived, and one of them is actually during the time of Hammurabi. Mm-hmm. So that is interesting, yeah. And there are tons and tons of laws. It's interesting because it, you know, parallels Mishpatim, but it's different. And this is one of my favorite things to do. So number eight, we're going to see it. It parallels, you know, the laws here in Mishpatim about stealing livestock, but it's different. And the differences are similar to what Nahama spoke about. But here, this table, you haven't had as much of a chance with the English. Well, it's translation. Number 8, who wants to take it? And this is the Code of Hammurabi, you know, a roughly contemporary code of law as Mishpatim, written by Hammurabi, the ruler of a unified Babylon. You go for it.
If anyone steal cattle or sheep or an ass or a pig or a goat, if it belong to a god, to the court, the thief shall pay 30-fold therefore. If they belong to a freed man of the king, he shall pay 10-fold. If the thief has nothing with which to pay, he shall be put to death.
Okay, so it really is what? So how is it different?
If you have money, you can get away with anything.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
You're a politician, whatever it is.
Okay, good.
And also that
Yeah.
thing becomes an avenue for improvement
over this. Okay, good, good, very good. And okay, good. So first of all, right, we have the problem that a thief with nothing is killed. So we have capital punishment for stealing. The way which the punishment is meting out depends on the means of the thief, and not on anything else.
The payout's
much
more.
Okay, good. The payout's much more in general.
If you don't have anything, don't steal anything.
That's really hard. White collar crime. Here we go. The other thing interesting, steal a cattle, if it belonged to a god or to the court, the thief shall pay 30-fold. If they belong to a freedman of the king, you shall pay 10-fold. So what is the another reason a difference in payment would exist is
who,
depends on what?
Who it belonged to.
Who it belonged to. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the Torah differentiates on very different, for very, very different circumstances than the Code of Hammurabi does, and the Code of Hammurabi is much
Well, when
stricter.
They say 10-fold, of what?
Okay,
what
so... Right.
I mean, he stole a sheep, he has to give 10 of them?
Yeah, according to the Code of Hammurabi. Well, right. So I didn't, I honestly wanted to, I want to save on paper, but rule number 9 might deal with that, I'm not sure. I didn't print out the whole thing, because, I mean, again, there are almost 200 different laws, so...
I once read excerpts from the Code of Hammurabi, I forgot what book it was in, but it was interesting to me that there were some rights that he gave to women. What it was, but there were certain things that if a woman
could be
this and this, or I don't know what it had to do with divorce is probably property.
It deals with women a lot, sometimes in some, I remember, because I did a comparison once on the laws of rape. I do think it's stricter in terms of, not stricter, but, you know, not exactly female friendly on that, but I don't remember. But it is interesting. If you pick any of the Mishpatim, Google, you know, you could usually find a corresponding law in the Code of Hammurabi. And it's interesting. The ones that don't exist, it's also interesting to figure out, you know, why there's no parallel there.
Does she go into discussion on this?
No.
It's confusing.
Oh, well, okay. Well, this, by the way, this Mishpatim, the first one, I don't know how far you usually get. It's a very long one. It's a long one. I mean, no, so she, well, okay, so what is she? So, okay, so we finished Code of Hammurabi. Let me see where she goes with us. Okay. Da-da-da-da. Okay. No, okay, so she, no. I mean, she really just, with this, she's pointing out that the differences in stealing in the Chumash depends upon if you've stolen a sheep or an ox, and they also depend if you have it in your possession or not, versus the Code of Hammurabi depends on a lot of different things. I mean, I think what she's saying implicitly is, you know, their value system depends on, like you said, poor people just are up a creek, and also, you know, you steal from somebody important, it's much worse than if you don't. Now, what is our value system? In other words, why do we differentiate between a sheep and the ox? What is that teaching us? And why do we differentiate between if you have it in your possession or not? You know, the philosophy of law here.
But here on number 8, it doesn't make a differentiation between the kosher animals and the treif animals.
Why not? Right, because Code of Hammurabi.
So, again, why?
Well, right. Why? So, why does the Code of Hammurabi?
These are put together. Oh, the goat.
Yeah, it says here. cattle, sheep.
The rock. I'm trying to see that they're in the Louvre now. They brought it to the French, or like a, there's a famous piece of it in the Louvre.
But it doesn't have anything to do with Islam.
No, no, no. Remember, this is I think 1800 BCE. Islam is 600 CE. So yeah. No. He was not a thought in their mind. But right, there is again probably the most you'd have is Abraham. But you know, Mishpatim come, let's say 200 years after Abraham, so it's roughly contemporary of Mishpatim. Anyway, okay, but let's get to some answers. We've gotten the questions, let's get to some answers. This table, sorry.
There's a discussion, I don't know who discusses it, about paying back less if you stole a sheep.
Yeah, good. So let's get there. Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. So let's see. You know what? Let's... Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. Let's skip. Am I the only one with a book? Somebody at this table. Okay, we'll keep it at that table. The first thing she deals with, let's go to 363. Okay, her first question that she deals with is, why is there a difference between whether you have in your possession and you fenced it or killed it? So 363, the middle. She says, let us tackle the first question first. There are three parties to the situation. The thief, the victim, and the judge are respectively taken into consideration in the analysis of the penalty. Daub, see note 4, Daub is a modern-day scholar, points to the objectivity of the proof of theft which exists when the animal has actually been slaughtered or sold. So long as the animal remains intact in the domain of the thief, he can argue that it had merely run away and that he was going, in any case, to restore it to its owner. Only when he has actually misappropriated it by positive action can it be finally proved that the theft was committed. So Daub takes a kind of, you know, practical approach to why if you still have it, you only have to pay back that sheep and one other sheep, because hey, you could say, you know, it wandered into my yard, I was just watching and I was going to give it back to you, versus if you've fenced it and, you know, you've made money off of it, sorry, you definitely stole it for, to steal it. So let me see, she has some other, just to go back, okay. So that's one answer there. Let's see. What else? Okay. Any other ideas about that one? Because then I'm going to turn the page and start to deal with the 4 versus the 5. Okay. So we'll go to the difference between why... Once you've gotten rid of it, you only pay back 4 sheep, but you pay back 5 oxen. Now, what did you say to begin with about stealing a sheep versus stealing an ox?
I said it was easier to steal a sheep than it was to steal an ox, because a sheep you could pick up and carry it. An ox you can't.
Okay.
The sheep might follow you. The ox would not.
So,
however, on the other hand, the ox does work.
Okay, good.
The sheep wouldn't.
Okay, good.
So well, you can get wool from the sheep, but you can't from the ox.
By the way,
she's
involved. Yeah, good. Yeah, so you've, okay, good, perfect. So you've pretty much anticipated where a lot of the different answers that we're going to do with the 4 and 5 thing. So that's on the last paragraph on 363. You guys all that table want to take over for a little bit? Here. I actually have notes on. You've got the book. pass the hot potato.
For the why, whether it's still in his property, his possession. Mm-hmm. But is that adequate motivation for the wide gap between the two and four and fivefold penalties? Others see the crucial factor determining the severity of the penalty in the damage suffered by the victim. The Torah Tamima finds support for this viewpoint in the Mechilta on Exodus 17:3. Why then did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill me, my sons, and cattle with themselves? They equated their cattle with themselves. From here they inferred the principle, a person's beast is his life. A traveler without his beast suffers hardship. The severity of the four or fivefold penalty must be understood in terms of the axiom that a person's beast is his life. Once the thief has sold or slaughtered it, the owner's prospects of getting it back are dashed forever. Here is the relevant passage from Torah Tamima. Sheep and cattle are the mainstay of the farmer's economy. Theft of them means much more to him than the theft of anything else. So long as they have not been slaughtered or sold and they are restored intact, the owner suffers nothing more than temporary hardship, for which the thief pays the penalty of a double indemnity. Ravenel, too, interprets the severity.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I misled you here. Just that Nechama is still going back to why you have to pay back a lot more, four or five times. You know, if you've gotten rid of the animal and you can't pay back the animal versus if you still have in your possession, you just pay back the sheep plus another one. So this one's interesting, especially interesting in the days, you know, now when they have, when you buy a chicken, there have been, you know, 10,000 other chickens farmers don't get attached to their chickens. Farmers don't get attached to their cattle anymore. But Torah Tamima quotes a midrash in which, you know, claims that people were actually attached to their animals. And if somebody stole your little sheepy, you were really upset. You know, that was your sheep. You wanted that exact sheep back. You had some sort of emotional attachment to it. So, you know, if you could get it back, then the thief didn't have to pay back as much as if you were never going to be reunited with your sheep again. You know, it was very emotionally difficult for you, and you had to pay back more. So, again, I don't know, you know, never lived that way. Don't know if it, you know, if it's true or not. I know nowadays people, farmers don't get attached to their farmers.
I know. It's a very interesting thing. I'll say it just very quickly. It's not about sheep or oxen, but it's about camels.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a wonderful article once in the National Geographic, and it talked about the camel's role for the people in the desert. And it occurred to me why camel is called gamal,
mm-hmm.
because it's gomel. It actually sustains the life of these people, just like it says this beast is his life.
Mm, that's true. Mm-hmm.
It's a gomel. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a nourisher.
No, sure. I mean, you know what they do? I'm sure that the way, you know, they say that the way we kill animals is just so, you know, we really have no understanding because we're so far removed from the process. In those days, you were much closer to the process, and apparently, you know, then there was much more of an impact when you lost the animal. So, yeah, so that's what the, you know, Torah Tamima says in the name of the filter for that. And so you've got an, okay, so the next, and then we have the opinion, our third opinion is the Barbanel. You can continue or pass it on, whatever you want. Pass it around.
How often in actuality, how many people were put to death because they couldn't because they couldn't afford to pay back what they stole?
The Code of Hammurabi. They got me.
I would guess that it didn't happen too often.
I don't. I mean, I'll tell you, I doubt we really know because I doubt we could have a good record. We know so little. The Code of Hammurabi is amazing because we know so little from what happened. If this is 1800 BCE, it's what, 4,000 years ago? I mean, we don't have much of a record.
They couldn't put so many people to
this. Well, I would say, if you just look at the couple you brought here, almost every one of them says put to death for something. So
right.
You would imagine it was probably
right.
A lot.
Right. Right.
Why not?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Right, well, I guess that'd be, they didn't have, there's no, by the way, there's no jail, remember, in the Code of Hammurabi, there's no such thing. So, I guess that's how they, but that's interesting, because when I'm teaching Mishpatim to, Well, high school kids can't wrap their brain. I mean, what's the main penalty in America nowadays? Jail, right? High school kids can't wrap their brains around the fact that, you know, that didn't exist. There is no, that is not. You paid, you got killed, you know, there. But you didn't go to jail. So I guess that was how they solved their overthinking.
They hang
people. Yeah.
They hang
people. Somebody jumps in the river. If the person sinks in the river, his accuser will take possession of his house. But if the river is not guilty,
they just cannot.
You've got to believe a lot of people were put to death because it was,
yes.
It's a strange thing. Yeah.
They could put that many people to death.
Yeah? So the scene is fine.
They hang him.
Well, they sound about the judgment.
Well, get it. Yeah. Well, you guys also are figuring out.
Excuse me, why does this make a difference to us?
Oh, well, okay, so this
right
is all...
today, why does this make a difference to us, well, what the goyim had?
Oh, you're asking a great question. I mean, anybody got any ideas?
We were farmers in those days.
Okay.
But this is what it doesn't apply to
right.
the Yiddish law.
Okay.
It doesn't apply to Torah law. Why do we care?
Okay, good. Why do we care? That's a great question. Good question. Right? Why do we care?
So we should understand why we have the laws we do because of what happened and what how they
yeah,
the rest
they
of
don't
the
world.
Well, going for later copies.
Yeah, but they were great architecture. That's the problem too.
Well, this was, in other words, this was. Let's say this is representative of law in the ancient Near East. Right there. I forgot there were no Christians. I mean, they were right. They were worshiped Marduk and all the other weird gods.
Yeah, I don't worship her.
But, I mean, I'll tell you, to me, you know, whenever I'm teaching Mishpatim, I mean, first of all, the case, you know, who steals an ox nowadays? You know? So, I mean, I think that's the first thing. You know, why are we talking about oxen? Because that's what it was in those days.
But it's like a
Right. No, I mean, in other words, so the first thing this helps you understand is why we're even using the language that we're using. So I'd say... But you would believe me if I didn't bring the Code of Hammurabi, good. Okay, but the second reason, in other words, I think that this is what makes the Torah so amazing. Because the Torah doesn't have the death penalty for stealing. Right? Hashem said, you know, this is... You know, we don't believe in this. We don't think that that's an appropriate penalty. The Torah doesn't make a difference between who you steal from. Everybody's equal in the eyes of, you know, you own property, then you are own property. It doesn't matter who you are. No matter if you're the mayor or the, you know, or the servant. You own property, here's the penalties if somebody takes it.
If you're a gun, if you're a gun.
Right, exactly. Another way. But, I mean, and again, I encourage you, if you just pick one law from Mishpatim, find it in Hammurabi, I'd argue that in every case, the Torah is much more humane, and again, the philosophy of law is something, you know, moral, which we agree, which even nowadays we would agree with, as opposed to the Code of Hammurabi.
Isn't that an understood? I mean...
Okay, I'm glad, yeah. you know...
But we can't take it for granted, really.
Why not?
Because without the Torah, people think all these other different ways still.
No, why can't you just study the Torah law? What do we care what you know?
How do we appreciate
what the guy who made all these?
Unless we see what the things would be like without it.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. This is. I mean, it's a good discussion. Some people don't need it. Some people like it. Right. You know. I mean, I find this particularly helpful when you get to a law in the Torah, which seems a little bit quote unquote outdated or cruel. Again, I don't want to keep harping on it, but the one that I find with high schoolers a lot is women's issues. What happens if a woman is a virgin is caught in a field? And a lot of times they can say, that's so mean, that's horrible, I can't believe the Torah writes that.
Yeah.
Well, compared to the Code of Hammurabi where she's killed, and you know what, the Torah seems very enlightened. So I find it helpful for that.
By the Muslims,
in other words,
by the Muslims, they still kill.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. Exactly.
They don't have to
kill.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If they do something, the women do something, they still kill.
Right here in Dearborn.
Yeah, that's a brother. They do that.
A brother killed his sister because she spoke to a Catholic.
It still happens.
Well, you have to write the quote of Rabbi Cohen.
Somebody else, she gets still killed.
What, in Islam?
Yeah, they do.
No, in other words, I think that,
that's why they cover themselves to, you know, and they still do it. So.
Right. So some of us haven't come that far from their Code of Hammurabi.
They uncover themselves.
But thankfully.
If a woman burns food, her husband can
You know what? We came close to that last Shabbos. Don't tell my husband that. Okay?
No, or if she eats the part that isn't burned and gives it to him, the burned part.
Well, boy, that's, I don't, this is not my, you know, my specialty, but I'm sure that there are a lot of parallels between, you know, this is an ancient Near Eastern law code. Islam grew out of that same area. So, you know, the other, I mean, again, quote Hammurabi is actually famous. It has the famous line, eye for an eye. Now, the Torah has the exact same line, but everybody darshans that it is not literal, it's figurative. So, you know, you already see the, you know, rate of morality, whatever you want to call it, of the Torah. And apparently some cultures still do the eye for an eye. So, you know. So that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Why do we care?
Right.
Why do we care?
Why does it matter? Why do we have to do it?
It helps us be become
one. Okay, good.
It's history.
Okay, so without that, you wouldn't appreciate the Torah if you didn't know this.
Yeah, but how many? What if a person doesn't learn Torah and he grows up in a society where everything is going on like this?
Okay, I don't barf it out. Okay, good. I want to get two more answers to the differences between the if you have in your possession and you don't, and then I want to move to the 4 versus 5 because we don't have that much time left. Okay, so you were at a bar now. You can continue, pass it on, whatever works.
So can I summarize some?
Yeah, please do. That's good.
Okay, great. Talk about comparing the work of the female and male animals. So if somebody paid back 2 males for 1 sheep he had stolen. He was therefore required to pay back 4 ewes, which were not worth as much as 2 rams. Okay, so that there's some kind of trade-off with how much the different animals were worth.
I don't remember. Yeah, all I have for Barbanel's value.
More valuable because they could.
They can breed.
Yeah, but they're a dime a dozen. Now, a dime a dozen is a big herd of them, but they're only a few good.
There are only a few good brands.
That's true. Well, again, you're going to see that, you know, it's interesting. I think one person can posit, like, you know, males are superior to females, the other one will say the opposite. So you're safe wherever you go with this one, basically. But we're good. I remember the Avarvanel, for some reason, bases his difference on value. That's what I have written down there.
Like Kiva observed in Sefer Babakama.
This is an interesting one.
That if you have an ox to dispose of, you have to do a lot more averus to get rid of it.
And you don't have oxes.
You have to steal it, and then you have to push it out. You have to tie it up. You have to push it over, and then get it ready for shefting. And then and when you sheft it, every action is considered an extra avera. You have to work harder at it. You keep doing an avera over and over again.
Okay.
You become rooted in an averas, and you have to do more payback because you persisted and you worked hard to continue to do that avera. Compared to just getting a sheep. So that's wonderful.
Or not even forget even the difference between the sheep and the ox. Again, if you don't have it in your possession, I would say in our, you know, the way we talk, you become a hardened criminal. Not only did you take it, you worked hard to, you know, you fenced it, you got rid of it. In Rabbi Kiva, you know, every action, you've become more a part of the crime. The crime has gone into you, so you need more restitution. If it's still sitting in your house, you know, either you're a novice thief, you don't have the stomach to get rid of it. To a certain degree, you haven't become as much a part of the crime. So you only have to pay back double versus if you've worked hard at the crime, accumulated all they wrote, you do need to pay back more. So that would be the difference between if you have it in your possession or not.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a comparison in the value of the ox versus the sheep. Philo says the ox contributes more than the sheep.
Okay, so now we're into the difference between why, this is the same case, why once you've gotten rid of the animal, if it's an ox you have to pay back 1 more versus if it's a sheep you only have to pay back 4. So we're going to have, just so you know where we're going with this, the structure, we're going to have Philo, we have a Midrash, we have Philo, and then we have 3 other opinions here.
So you have the opinion that a sheep contributes milk, cheese, wool, and lambs. The ox contributes milk, cheese, calves, and plowing and threshing.
Ah, Okay? So if someone's taken your ox, they've taken, you know, more value. You haven't been able to plow your field. You have, you know, you're missing your work animal. Sheep is not your work animal. So, you know, you've incurred more damages if you're missing your ox. Again, I don't... I think it's a male.
It's a male.
Yeah.
It's milk?
That's what
well,
I mean.
Ox
the cow
give.
That gives
milk. The
species.
I don't see... I don't think here we're interested at all if it's male versus female. But the point is the person took the species of ox. Male, female, it doesn't matter. The different, you know, we're concentrating on the difference between the ox and the sheep. So I don't think it matters. Again, I know. I mean,
sheep is a ram.
I can't imagine them having.
Right, but I'm saying there was that case in the Torah. I don't think it's talking specifically if he stole, you know, a ram versus a ewe or an ox versus a cow. I think just the point is it an ox? Is it from the cattle species or is it from the sheep species?
I think it's the cattle.
Right, so in other words, the point is cattle you would also use as a beast of burden. You know, it's a pull a plow, the female for milk versus sheep, you know, you don't use for those two things. So, again, you've incurred less damage, so you get paid back less.
The Torah Shlema is looking at the details. She says it's very weak because you shouldn't count milk and cheese as two separate things. But
okay, good. Well, does anybody, there's another, I mean, the interesting conundrum here also is when the thief has gotten rid of it, there's a difference in whether you it's a sheep or a cow. Sheep, you only pay back four. If it's a cow, you pay back five. If the thief still has it in his possession, it's two for both. So a really elegant answer would have to explain not only why the difference exists, but why it only exists in the first case. Now, I don't think any of them do, but that is, you know, just to put that out there.
Well, when the thief got rid of the same animal, he received more benefit from it, obviously, from the cattle than he would have from the sheep. I'm going to sell you, you an ox, or if I'm going to sell you a sheep. There's a whole, I'm probably going to get more money for that ox.
Right, but then he said, I mean, but he'd have to pay you back more money for every sheep anyway. And the proportions would stay the same. The proportion, you know, it should stay the same. But anyway, that's just a side point there. But okay, good. So Philo bases, you know, the difference on the fact that you lost more when you lost your ox, so he has to pay you back more. You know, you lost
and
that extra.
And he's the burden and plowing with it, so...
Oh, this is an interesting one. Actually, here, do you want to switch to this table?
No, sir.
This is, so we're done. Philo, we're up to now in the Mechilta and the Midrash. And this is what I was talking about, philosophy of law. This Midrash is not going to, you know, try to figure out beast of burden, you know, practical physical things, but the moral lesson we can draw from having to pay back four versus five. And there are a couple answers.
Starting with David Ezra.
Okay, no, but Ibn Ezra really just supports the, okay, let's go one up. Philo's noting of the value that's in the point of elaboration from the commentators here. Let's put it up here at the top of the page.
Philo's noting of the value of an ox as a beast of burden, a point elaborated by our sages and commentators. I'll skip the Hebrew. Five oxen shall he pay, four plus one. Four sheep, three plus one. Rabbi Meir stated, come and see how highly valued is labor by him who spoke, and the world come into being. The ox which contributes labor involves fivefold indemnity. The sheep which contributes no labor involves a fourfold indemnity. The Ibn Ezra, in the name of Sajjah al-Gaon, comments, the damage caused to the owner of the ox is more because he plows with it. Similar as the two explanations are, there is a significant difference between them. Sajjah confines himself to the financial loss incurred by the farmer. Rabbi Meir, however, is concerned with the debit on the ethical side too for the owner of the ox. The formulation, come and see how highly valued is labor, stresses that labor is not only a means of obtaining a livelihood, but a value in itself. Other interpretations base the difference between the penalty for sheep and ox stealing on consideration of the gravity and prevalence of the crime.
Okay, so this is really what you were talking about. Okay, just to go back. So in other words, Nachama is making the point about the mechilta that the Midrash is teaching us the moral lesson, not even literally that the, you know, you incurred more damages because you usually use your ox, but also to teach the thief a lesson. You took a beast, you know, a working animal, and you took work away from somebody. You're a lazy bum. You tried to do something lazy because you didn't want to work. We want to show you the value of how important work is. You have to pay back an extra ox because the ox is more of the working animal than the sheep. Good. Then you went ahead to this whole now. So that's kind of okay. So we have, you know, the basic idea that really physically an ox is more valuable. You lost more, give it back. We have a moral lesson kind of thing. The thief needs to understand the value of work. And now, if you want to start reading, we enter upon the whole discussion of, do we punish crimes that are more severe with more, or crimes that are less severe with more? Is it a deterrent or a punishment? And what is easier or harder to do, to steal a steel sheep or to steal an ox? So here we go.
Most Gentile scholars take the view that since sheep stealing is easier to execute and therefore more prevalent, it is regarded in a less serious light by the Torah. In contrast, Rambam observes, the more prevalent the transgression, the more serious the penalty to act as a deterrent. The less frequent, the lighter the penalty. For this reason, theft of a sheep carries a penalty twice as heavy as that meted out for the theft of other objects, four instead of twofold, if he disposed of them. This was usual since it was difficult for the thief to conceal them. For theft of an ox, the lawgiver increased the penalty by one to fivefold because the offense was easier to commit. Sheep are easier to guard since they keep together. The large cattle are widely scattered in the pasture, and it is impossible for the shepherd to keep an eye on all of them all the time. Hence, ox stealing is more frequent.
Right, so you can argue. Right, so that, I mean, that she's going to... Okay, good. She's then going to explain how... Okay, so this opinion seemed to say... I'm getting confused. She brings two differing opinions here. Did you read them through? So... Right now, the one you just read is that ox stealing, no, that sheep stealing is easier and more common. Therefore, it is less penalized.
Which also right? Is Ibn Ezra.
Okay, Ibn Ezra. Versus Rambam's going to say that ox stealing is more prevalent, so it is more penalized because, you know, if something's going on a lot, we've got to lay down the law, get tough with it, and try to make more of a deterrent for it.
Let's look at it from the side of the thief.
Right.
Because it keeps talking about if the thief doesn't have enough to pay back, so you kill him.
That's kind of a robbery. That's not.
No. Right. So here we go. Yeah. So he's supposed to pay back to whatever, and he doesn't have any, so he has to go and steal from somebody else to pay back what he stole from the first person. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, that's, I mean, if you...
To save his life.
If you go through...
Well, that's put it on rubbish, yeah.
I mean, really, if you follow it through...
Well, yeah, I mean, again, so...
You should
by the way,
wash it.
Well, this is why you have a machloket here. You know, some people are going to say I think it's a question of philosophy of law. Some of Farshim read this as being a question, is it a deterrent or not? Some of Farshim think, yes, a sharper penalty, a harsher penalty is a deterrent. Some say no. Elu ve'elu, you fall out there, other people fall out there. That's why we have, you know, that's why the Torah is so wonderful. Pick your side. But again, the Torah doesn't tell us why you have the different penalties, which is why we can have a machloket between Rambam and Ibn Ezra about it. We also have a machloket about facts here. What was easier? What was more prevalent? Don't know.
They should have asked the thieves.
Well, yeah.
They actually go into, you know, the detail, into Torah law
right.
In detail.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you have to consider the financial situation of the ganef?
What you're seeing, by the way, is only, I mean, again, what you're seeing, this is why it's a little hard. Chaf Aleph, you're seeing, you know, if the thief can pay back. I didn't copy the rest of the psukim here. The subsequent psukim start to talk about the laws of slavery. Why? Because if a thief can pay back, he is sold into slavery until he can pay it back. So, yeah, he's not killed.
So
He sold him for slave.
How can he pay back after being a slave? He doesn't get paid.
He would get paid. So let's say they paid $10,000 for his body. That money would go, I believe, to the person he stole from.
That's love and magic.
And then, he would definitely get free memories in Eben Ivri. He'd definitely be free by the Shemitah year. So the maximum would be a 7-year. 7-year.
Hard life.
Something. And again, she talks about it in subsequent articles, the whole question of, the laws of Eben Ivri. And this is another place where Kodesh HaMarabi, at least I find, comes in handy. Kids will look at it and say, one second, as Americans, we think slavery is highly immoral. We abolished it, we had a whole war about it. And I mean, nobody on the street nowadays will tell you slavery is moral. What's the Torah doing having all these laws of slaves? Compared to the Code of Hammurabi, our laws of slaves are positively humane and wonderful.
Definitely.
In comparison. So.
So
let's end. This is a perfect ending, okay? This is the answer that somebody said, the famous answer. Why do we have the difference between 4 and 5 between an ox and a sheep? Take it away.
Okay. An entirely different approach is to be found in Mechilta. Though it appears far-fetched, it tells us a great deal about the delicacy of feeling of our senses. By Yochanan ben Zakkai stated, the Holy One, blessed be He, was concerned for the self-respect of His creatures. For the ox which walks on its own 4 feet, he, the thief, repays 5-fold. For the sheep which he has to carry on his shoulder, he pays 4-fold. In other words, the penalty takes into account as an extenuating circumstance the humiliation suffered by the thief in executing the robbery. The Torah does not ignore the feelings of any human being, even the one who has forfeited his own self-respect by resorting to stealing. Not even humiliation suffered in solitude, for a thief never steals in full public. Mm-hmm.
So again,
the one who steals publicly, as it were, and the thief who is ashamed and does it privately.
Right. Good. Good, excellent. And again, this midrash philosophy of law that, if the thief had to go through humiliation, we don't make him pay as much if he did in humiliation, versus if he doesn't know why, he has to pay more. So the midrash teaching us, the law teaches us a moral lesson about the dignity of men and women, even thieves. And that's how she ends it.
Which is interesting. This is the kind of thing that's taught to our students, and I guess Jewish students with a Jewish education take it for granted that even the feelings of thief are considered, whereas the rest of the world certainly does not have that mindset at all.
Yeah, let me dress. And again, that would be, obviously completely revolutionary considering the Code of Hammurabi, who, will kill him off pretty easily.
Now we know everything.
Okay, now we know everything.